Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
Today, we're speaking with Alex Ferber, co-founder and partner at Green Egg Ventures, an early stage fund based in New York that focuses on software companies across multiple verticals. So Alex, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really looking forward to the conversation. And to start it off, we'd love to learn more about Green Egg Ventures. And most importantly, because I know Thanasis and I and others are thinking about it, where does the name come from?
Yes, thanks for having me. Our initial name was actually Support Capital, which we felt was a little bit on the nose. So we wanted to come up with something a little bit more creative. In the same way that we help companies get going at the very early stages, we thought to be similar to like breakfast foods, which helps people get going in the morning. We landed on Cold Brew Ventures and Double Shot Ventures. However, people associated Cold Brew and Double Shot with beer and tequila rather than coffee and espresso. So we ended up landing on Green Egg Ventures, just with green representing money and growth, egg representing like a seed, and we do seed investing. And then of course, the Dr. Seuss book, Green Eggs and Ham, being very memorable makes, you know, our name more memorable. So that's how we ended up landing on Green Egg Ventures.
Yeah, very creative. So what is your breakfast of choice?
It's kind of ironic because I actually intermittent fast now. So I never have
breakfast
in my life.
So not an appropriate question. Okay. All right.
But if I am partial to omelets, so any kind of veggie omelet, I do love at any time in the day.
Can't go wrong with that. Breakfast to dinner is also great. And so tell us about the strategy of the fund.
Yes. Green Egg Ventures, we are very broad on industry. So we do all things B2B software. B2B can be anywhere from enterprise all the way down for tools for freelancers. What we avoid is anything that requires consumer adoption to scale, any hardware, and anything biotech. Where we are a lot more focused is on the stage of the business. We try to hit the Goldilocks zone of investing in companies that are post-product market fit, but still early enough that they're at a 10 million or lower valuation. And it's really important that we find that zone because we want to make sure that any company that we invest in has some semblance of product market fit, but has enough upside that if there is an exit in the hundreds of millions, that we still are going to get a very meaningful multiple. So we play in that space. And just by the nature of where we invest, I would say that while we're in a risky space, we are much more conservative as investors. We're investing, like I said, in companies that have traction. Typically, they're more in niche markets and, I guess, quote unquote, unsexy spaces where companies aren't getting crazy high valuations with a little bit of traction.
What are you seeing on the valuation side these days?
Yeah, it's a great question. If you asked me about a month and a half ago, I would say that things haven't really changed much despite everything happening. But I have been noticing recently valuations in the pre-seed and seed stage starting to come down. For the first time since it feels like maybe 2020, early 2020, we're seeing some startups that are raising in the $5 to $6 million range in a pre-money valuation, raising $1 million, which was getting much, much more rare through 2021 and into 2022. So we are finally seeing valuations come back to earth a little bit.
Always a good thing.
Yes.
And how much competition are you seeing, Alex, in New York these days at that stage? Talk to us a little bit about the dynamic in the market. Are people typically getting multiple term sheets, or is this still very much an eclectic game and everybody's focusing on their own sectors?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the one thing that you've probably heard a lot about New York City is that it's pretty collaborative. We're always meeting up with each other at different events. We're part of deal sharing groups. And speaking about Green Egg Ventures specifically, just by the nature of our check size and the stage that we're investing, we're not really knocking anybody out of the round. And considering the value that we add to our companies, we're usually able to get founders to raise a little bit more than they might have been anticipating for some of the best companies. I think that these rounds are more competitive for the lead investors that are competing on term sheets. Green Egg Ventures ourselves, we're more of a pre-seed investor where we're coming into rounds that don't necessarily have a lead, or you know, when we're coming into a round, it's more as a follow-on investor. So for us, it's a big thing that we do is maintain great relationships with these lead investors or other investors and try to include as many great investors into these rounds as possible.
So very collaborative rounds, basically.
Yes.
Can take maybe is one way of accommodating the risk. And then I assume that then you double down, assuming the company's doing well at the seed round or the A round?
Exactly. Yeah, we doubled down at the later round. In our second fund right now, we've done 32 companies and we've followed on into 15 of them so far. So we've been very active on that front. One thing I want to say about that as well is, you know, with the current economy, a lot of our portfolio companies that we're going to go out and raise a Series A have been looking at their 12 to 18 months of runway and have been thinking, hey, let's get another year here. There's a lot of uncertainty around the markets. And it's really allowed us as a fund to reinvest into more of our companies. Whereas we thought if we're reinvesting at the A round, we'd have to do much larger checks to maintain our pro rata. With these more like pre-Series A bridge type rounds, we've been able to really reinvest into a lot of our companies, which has been great. So I would say a little bit over half of our fund is earmarked for following on.
Yeah. Did you want to highlight one of the companies in your portfolio?
It's so tough to choose a company in the portfolio. They're all like my babies. But if I were to highlight one right now, just because they had a recent round of fundraising and it's one that we reinvested in, I'll highlight Shibodi. They're a company based out of Vancouver, and Shibodi is in the 5G infrastructure space. So the idea is that in the way that 4G has revolutionized consumer apps with things like Uber, Spotify, 5G is in a state where it can really revolutionize enterprise applications. So imagine you have a facility with autonomous robots, or you're a hospital that wants to start utilizing remote surgery. Those things need a minimum amount of latency, sorry, minimum amount of bandwidth to properly function, right? So what Shibodi does is they allow developers to build applications that take advantage of 5G networks. So they're putting the infrastructure in place so developers can go in and build the infrastructure for these applications to run on 5G networks that can power autonomous vehicles, like I said, remote surgery, smart manufacturing. So we're super excited about them. They just raised over $10 million Series A round that we participated in.
How do you find deals? Talk to us a little bit about the dynamic of sourcing deals at the pre-seed stage. What do you do day in, day out? How do you hunt for promising ideas?
That's a great question. And there's a lot of different angles that I can touch on. The first one I'm going to touch on is the idea of being friends with the fishermen rather than trying to go out and catch every fish ourselves. And in that, I mean, for us, we take very serious our relationship with other investors, the value that we're adding to our portfolio companies. For us, it's important to be top of mind for investors when we're seeing deals that are in our sweet spot. So I think having a very focused stage that we invest at, which is the $10 million or lower valuation, post-product market fit, really helps us come to mind for investors when they see companies that are in our focus. So to answer your question, firstly, a lot of our deals come from other investors, funds that are leading rounds, companies that might be too early for some of the later investors that know where we invest stage-wise. We, of course, do our own outreach. We're always seeing what companies are coming out of different incubators, accelerators, or any other groups out there. We do our own research and, like I said, reach out cold to some companies. We get a lot of cold inbound ourselves. And just by having our name out there, taking part in podcasts like this, sitting on panels, that's the way that we get a lot of inbound. And at the end of the day, what I'll say is what's important as a fund is that we add value to our portfolio companies, firstly. And secondly, is just be a value-added member of the ecosystem in New York and just be well-liked, right? Taking an interest in other investors' lives, sharing knowledge that we're seeing. I have monthly meetup sessions with tons of investors. So it's really just about engaging the community, being top of mind, and then once an investor knows that we're adding value to our portfolio companies, then they're much more likely to share. And lastly, our portfolio companies, we have 52 of them now between our two funds, are always sharing us deals as well, friends that are founding companies. I think that deal flow is the lifeblood of any fund. And the more good deals you see, the better deals you're going to invest in. So for us, that's like laser focused on deal flow.
Got it.
And so how do you strive to add value to your portfolio companies? And do you want to give an example of one or two companies that you've worked with and how you added value for them?
For sure. A lot of the folks that we invest in are they're real estate brokers that worked in the industry for 10 to 15 years and are going out to found their own company, right? They understand their market really well. They understand the problem that they're trying to solve, but they don't necessarily understand how to navigate an early stage startup, right? And so for us, the areas that we help in are really getting our companies from that pre-seed stage to the first institutional round of investment. And we like to say there's three or four ways specifically that we do that. The first is with fundraising, obviously, going through their decks, hearing their pitches, making introductions to other funds. Secondly would be hiring, figuring out who their ideal hire is, going into our networks or going through LinkedIn for hours and finding a bunch of potential candidates that fit the mold of what that company is looking for. The third being lead generation, helping our companies with best practices in terms of finding leads or actually doing projects on their behalf. And then lastly is, I like to say, everything in between. So we like to, I guess, half jokingly say that if one of our founders needs to get their dogs walked because they have an important meeting, we'll come over and walk their dogs for them. And
you can call me for that too. I would totally do that.
Okay. I got you. I got you for sure. As I'm sure you know, running a startup is a roller coaster ride. It's full of ups and downs, and it can be a very stressful thing for anyone to go through. So for us, just being there, giving some context to what a founder is going through, everything's okay, this is how our companies have handled this in the past, those types of conversations are really helpful for someone who's dealing with these things for the first time. So those are some examples. To give you some more specific examples.
Before you get into that, I think the emotional turmoil that founders and management teams go through is not spoken about enough, right? There was a couple, I think it was an Inc. article that was out a couple of years ago. And those things are, you know, while intangible, they go a long way. And it's really important. So I commend you for that.
For sure. I appreciate it. No, it's great. And this is kind of a little off topic, but like the most rewarding part of my job is the journey with the founders, just seeing their story from beginning and helping them build it. So that plays into it. It's just being there, being in their corner the entire time is, for me, is one of the most rewarding parts of the job. But to get back on topic and to give you some examples, I can give you an example of each quickly, starting with hiring. In one of our best investments so far, a company called Aqualist based in New York City, we helped them hire one of their first sales hires at the time before they raised their Series A round when they were still a seed stage company. We just combed LinkedIn and created a list and reached out on their behalf to all these candidates and was able to find a hire. In terms of funder, we've helped, I mentioned Shibodi, we found their lead investor for their seed in their Series A round. Marquee, I think we sourced three quarters, more than that, of their seed round that was led by Acronym. And then in terms of like lead generation, we did a project a little while ago with our company Philogic. They're in the logistics space, but we found the top D2C brands, found the head of inventory at these brands, and basically reached out on Philogic's behalf to all these brands and then connected them where necessary. So just to sum that up, the work that we do isn't necessarily super complicated, but it's work that when the company is worried about things that will kill the company, like running out of money or making sure the product doesn't break, we just help them with projects that are off to the side a little bit, like those. Yeah, that helps ease them a little bit.
You said something interesting. You said you target companies that are past the product market fit stage, but you're also investing in pre-seed. And obviously, it's different. Product market fit means different things to different people. And we actually, in our firm, we debate that all the time. So I'd be interested to see how you think about that at the pre-seed stage. Yeah, Jenny's joking because we had a company that we were kind of debating today on that subject.
Yeah, so you nailed it. Product market fit is extremely subjective, and there's different ways to get there for different investors. So for us, it's really about conducting 5 customer calls, for example, since we're doing B2B, we're talking to paid customers typically, and it's about hearing what the customer's life was like before they used the product and what the life is like after.
So you're saying I mean, that's a little bit astonishing that they actually, even though it's pre-seed, they actually have customers. So it means there's a product out there and people have paid money for it. Is that
exactly? Yeah. And I get the question a lot of, do these companies exist? And they exist for sure. There are companies at the pre-seed stage that have some customers. Obviously, if it's a company that's more enterprise, then we might be able to speak to 1 or 2 customers versus SMBs where we can speak to more. But there are companies out there that bootstrapped to their first customers, maybe raised a friend and family round, and have some customers that we can speak to for sure. It does mean that we have to say no to a lot of great deals that don't fit our thesis. But for us, it's important to stay very focused on what we do well, which is finding those types of companies.
So talk to us about your personal background and how you got into VC.
Yeah, I appreciate that question. Let's start with my background. Really, I have to start with my grandfather, who came to the US as an immigrant and as a Holocaust survivor. He moved here not speaking English with no money, and he basically started the foundation for our entire family. And I guess that gets to a question later, but that sort of led my father to found his own company, And it really instilled a feeling of entrepreneurship in our family. I'm very lucky in my life. I was raised working at my father's company day in, day out, working in different departments, working in the warehouse, working in logistics and fulfillment, sales, marketing, traveling to China, finding products that were being manufactured overseas, quality control. And it really gave me a great appreciation for all the pieces that go into a business, right? All the pieces working in tandem. And after college, my plan was to live in New York for a couple of years and then move back to Michigan, work at the family business. However, I got super lucky. I ended up interviewing at a venture fund with the goal of working at one of their portfolio companies. I never thought I would work in venture. And at the time, I had met with a gentleman by the name of Ben Kroll, who ended up hiring me to work at that firm called Metamorphic Ventures as an unpaid intern. And I figured I might as well take a chance here and do that. And my father always taught me when you have a good opportunity, you have to seize it. And he likes to say, you get in there like a Georgia tick and hold on for dear life. And that's what I did. I went in there. Yeah, I ingrained myself in a lot of the processes of the firm, tried to make myself as invaluable as possible, and then ended up getting a paid position there. And I fell in love with venture like immediately, and just meeting people that are much more brave than I am, that are starting these, you know, putting it all on the line to go out into the world, solve problems that they suffered every day, start these businesses. I knew I wanted to do it every day, just learning new things every day. And I knew I wanted to dedicate myself to the early stage founders out there. And now it's been 10 years in New York and haven't really looked back. And I ended up co-founding Green Egg after working at Metamorphic for a few years back in 2016. Now we're investing out of the end of our second fund and raising a third fund.
Awesome. And you have an amazing apartment, which we just learned you've been in for 2 years. I don't know how found it, but I'm going to steal it from you.
It was one of those COVID when the prices were super low. I wanted to live in West Village or Chelsea or somewhere. And then I found this place in Chinatown and it was just like way more spacious than anything I ever saw. Never thought I would live here too, but like I said, I haven't looked back and I now love the area.
So what's your perspective on the market dynamic now in terms of macro trends? What's happening? The economy has changed. 2022 was different. People are prognosticating about when we see the end of recession in the macro market and how that is affecting maybe companies that you're seeing. Are you still seeing a lot of entrepreneurs coming out and starting companies? What's your feeling about all this?
For sure. It's a great question and one I get a lot. I would be lying if I said that it wasn't nice when we would get mega up rounds from growth investors for our portfolio companies and seeing that share price skyrocket. However, I do have to say that what's happening or what has happened is stepping the right direction for the venture market as a whole. I think that what we were seeing in 2021 and into early 2022 was really unsustainable. And for us as a fund that we're investing at a $10 million or lower valuation in post-product market fit companies, it really was a threat in a lot of ways to the way that we invest, as a lot of those companies were starting to disappear into the $15 to $20 million range. So what's happening now, like I said, I think is healthy for the markets. When it comes to early stage venture, we're investing 7 to 10 years into the future. So I think that a lot of, especially institutional investors or people that understand the way that early stage venture capital works, appreciate that innovation is going to continue. You know, software will continue to disrupt industries going forward, especially more of the old school ones. So I think people that have that long-term vision of early stage venture, you know, the market, while can be just concerning, it still isn't an indication of where it will be in 7 to 10 years when our companies end up going public.
Are you seeing late stage investors being active? What we're hearing, a lot of people are quote unquote pencils down. Right.
A lot less active.
Which means that then syndicates have to, you know, if you're trying to avoid raising a round at a valuation that maybe is a down round, then you got to put an inside round together and give the company some runway. Is that kind of a running theme with some of the more mature companies in your portfolio?
Yeah. As I mentioned before, a lot of our companies that have had this 8 to 16 months of runway have been going to the previous investors for a follow-on round recently. And that's due in large part because not only are Series A investors less active or growth stage investors less active, but the metrics that the companies raise their seed rounds at, where they said, when we reach this ARR, we can then raise a Series A round. Now that ARR is expected to be higher, or whatever metric is expected to be higher. So the runway that these companies raised to reach certain metrics is now not enough. So there have been a lot more of those sort of insider rounds. What has worked out well for us is that when our company, so our average valuation for our second fund is at $7.7 million, like the average that we put our initial investment in. So it's much easier to raise a pre-Series A round at a $10 million, $12, $15 million valuation than if they had raised pre-revenue seed round at a $20 million valuation, now looking to raise a bridge at higher. So for us, we haven't had any down rounds in our portfolio, but as you nailed, there have been less Series A rounds that have come in, and it's caused more bridge rounds, which I think has worked in our favor as we were able to gain more equity in our portfolio.
And speaking to the 7 to 10 year timeframe, any predictions for what VC looks like 5 to 10 years
bigger
out?
That's I honestly can't even predict what I'm going to see startup wise next week. One thing that always astonishes me about my job and why I love it so much is that I just learn. I meet a company that, like I said, is solving a problem in a space I never knew existed, and I dive into it and never realized how big of a problem this is, how massive it is. And just when I think that there are people running out of ideas, that obviously never happened. So it's, for me, I think my mentality is to just go with the flow rather than trying to create my own idea of what I think is going to happen and then invest towards that. It's just my general strategy.
How did you get to meet and work with your partners?
So my partner, Jared, who I co-founded Green Egg with, we went to the same university, University of Michigan, and he, before co-founding Green Egg with me, had co-founded a startup that was acquired. Having the background at the venture firm I was at before, I was really looking for someone that had more of an operating experience. And then we added Stefan to our team, and I got introduced to Stefan through, I mentioned Acrolis, one of our best investment out of our first fund. The CEO of that company is good friends with Stefan, and Stefan's background was more in institutional investing. So as we as a fund look to grow and raise money from institutional investors, him bringing that background really adds a lot. It's us three on the team right now.
Awesome. And were you at the Ross School, or were you on the technical side? Or
I wish I was on the technical side looking back, but I did do go to Ross. I was an undergrad there and graduated in 2012.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So a topic that you can't hide from, even if you wanted to, ChatGPT. Do you incorporate it into anything that, you know, you guys do? Any due diligence, investment memos, sourcing?
We have not used it yet, but I'm not going to say it's because I feel like we can do it better or anything. I can be a creature of habits sometimes and like to do things myself. So we haven't utilized it yet. We do a lot of updates for our investors and things like that. So maybe it would be nice to play around with it and see if it can save us some time. Or we send a lot of emails, as you can imagine, a lot of similar type of emails. We have not used it yet, though, to answer your question, but we'll look into it a little bit more going forward.
And now we're going to switch to our standard last part of our podcast, which is basically us asking you some standard questions. And the first is our NVCA question. So the National Venture Capital Association advocates for public policy and supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem. So if there's one thing that maybe you would change about the VC industry or a policy that you would advocate for, what would that be?
That's a great question. And thinking about this a little bit, this is something that we're a culprit of right now, but we're updating our website and going to fix it. I think that funds in general can be, especially on their websites, can be very broad about the space that they invest in, what interests them, what makes them interested specifically in investing in different types of companies. And I think it can be a disservice to a lot of founders that are reaching out, being told that it isn't a fit for them, not understanding why. I think being clear about the types of businesses that you invest in, what excites you, the valuations or revenue minimums, I think would go a long way in helping founders concentrate who they should be reaching out to and having better clarity, which firms they should be reaching out to and why. So I know that being general, it helps us as funds get more deal flow and helps people that might be on the fence send their information over. But I think that it creates a lot of inefficiencies for both the funds and for the founders.
Great. Second question is, if you were not a VC investor and money was not a concern, what career would you have?
Okay. So the easy answer is a professional skier, but I'm not good enough to be that. So I recently got into DJing and I just love music. I love playing for friends. I love making mixes. Music's a very important part of my life. So if money didn't mean anything, if money wasn't an issue and I could do anything I wanted, I'd probably just make music all day.
I'm suspecting we're going to ask you to play something on your roof deck.
I got you. Come over when I love playing. That's so if you're going to do some rooftop sets when it gets warm out. So you're both always welcome.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. Believe it or not, actually, DJing and being a professional skier have
the two
come
most
up.
Common.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah.
I guess we're creatures of ourselves, venture capitalists. But yeah, we like similar things.
Great. Question three is, who's someone you look up to and why?
Yeah, that's a very easy question for me. And that's my grandfather. I'm very fortunate to have him in my life today. Just celebrated his 94th birthday.
Oh, 94. Wow.
94th birthday. And yeah, on Christmas Day, I was with him in Boca Raton. And he, like I mentioned, is a Holocaust survivor. He was a little kid then, right? He was a little kid. Yeah, he was a little kid. I think he was coming into his teens when it started, or was an early teenager. But every time that one of the grandkids turns 18, he takes us along with my grandmother, who's also my hero. And she was a hidden child and didn't know. She was given away to a family to be raised Catholic and didn't know she was Jewish till she was 16. But they always take everyone to Poland and just show us what they went through. My grandfather showing me where he snuck under the wall in the ghetto to sneak back food for his family, some of his stories in the concentration camps, and not only to go through that experience, but to come to the U.S., build a life and a foundation for our family that we get to live off the fruits of, and just the type of person that he is, that's just so wise and positive and looking to share what he's learned throughout life with people when he has every excuse to not be that way. It really, it means the world to me, and it gives me a lot of confidence that if someone like him can overcome the challenges that he went through in life, mine are pretty insignificant in comparison. So it makes me feel like I can really run through walls and solve the problems that come up in my life. He's definitely a constant source for me of inspiration and someone I'll always look up to.
What a great story, and kudos to you for honoring him and his background. I'm curious, did he lose his family, or was he one of the few survivors from his family? What?
There were some survivors, but in his immediate family, it was only him and his mother that survived. But yeah, there's a longer story there, but he witnessed the rest of his family perish. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing. It's great that you still have him around in your life, it's great for us to learn lessons of history from people. And it seems so far away, but it's people still around. It's amazing.
It is. Yeah, it is. He's living treasure right now. We just want to wrap him in bubble wrap and keep him around as long as we can. He's a legend.
Awesome. And final question is, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
So I'll be a little bit more recent, just because it's top of mind. I've recently gotten very deep into meditating, which I wish I would have done sooner in my life. And I think that the one thing for me that's been really life-changing is that in the past, if I was nervous before having, for example, this podcast, or just wasn't feeling my best or feeling great, it just was in my subconsciousand just some sort of something I live with, or I would try to change the way I feel. But the best advice now is just with being okay with however I'm feeling in the moment, recognizing how I'm feeling, acknowledging how I'm feeling, and just letting it wash through me. It's really changed my life a lot, that mentality. So it's really just about not fighting those feelings and trying to feel a certain way, but just accepting how I feel in the moment and accepting the realities for the way they are.
Excellent.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And thank you again.
Awesome. Really appreciate you both taking the time. And yeah, thanks.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.